If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you criticise somebody for overambition and they fail every time, it's a fair point. I think if you criticise somebody for overambition where actually a lot of it's worked, then that's more problematic.
That was Caroline Burt on King Edward I.
One great thing in Africa, which I talk about, were this mythical mountain range called the Mountains of Kong.
And that was Simon Garfield discussing the history of maps. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast with me, Rob Attar. This podcast is brought to you by the team behind BBC History Magazine, which is the UK's best-selling history magazine. You can find it in all good newsagents and on subscription. Plus, we have a Kindle edition available on the Amazon website and an iPad edition on the Apple newsstand. We've also recently launched a Kindle Fire edition, and that's available on the Kindle newsstand. You can find out more details of all of this, plus great subscription offers, at our website, historyextra.com. And if you have any comments about the podcast, you can get in touch with us through email, podcast@historyextra.com, on Twitter, @HistoryExtra, or Facebook/HistoryExtra. England's King Edward I has long been a controversial figure, particularly due to his treatment of Scotland and Wales. Caroline Burt of Pembroke College, Cambridge, sets out to reassess his reputation in her new book, and our books editor, Matt Elton, spoke to her recently about her discoveries.
What would you say is the current prevailing view of Edward I?
I'd say it was quite mixed. It started off many years ago being much more positive than it is now, and then criticisms started to emerge among historians in the 20th century. But in the late 20th century, early 21st century, people started to think about some of the positives about Edward. So the way he handled the start of his reign and the legacy of Henry III, for example, the way he handled his nobility. So it's currently a bit mixed.
Okay. So in your opinion, what were the key things about being king for Edward?
Well, I think he thought kingship meant something very distinct. And for him, at the core was maintaining the dignity of the office that he held. That was something he was absolutely committed to. And that in practice really meant that he was to protect the good of his people, because if he didn't, then that reflected really badly on him and therefore on the office. And he was to protect what belonged to the office. So, for example, the crown has lands, and you don't just let them be given away willy-nilly, because, of course, that loses you quite a lot of money. And it's not yours to give. You're only a steward of those lands. So for him, it is this dignity of the office that comprises these two really key elements.
Okay, and that's the central kind of theme that he saw as being a king, if that makes sense.
That underpins everything that he does. So, of course, if you're thinking about protecting the good of your people and your realm, then naturally that translates into stopping them being attacked on the Iwe and stopping the realm being invaded, just for example.
Okay. What were the biggest challenges that he faced in terms of upholding those principles?
Like any king, he faced disorder. He faced particular problems with disorder as a legacy of Henry III's reign, because there'd been a really big civil war in the late 1250s and 1260s, and Edward only took over about 10 years later. So that means that he inherits quite a difficult situation. Then, of course, like any king, there are outbreaks of problems in certain areas. And then, really badly, disorder that arises as a result of war in the 1290s that okay. gets really very serious. Aside from that, you've got issues with what he regarded as his sovereignty as king. So from his perspective, the Welsh prince, for example, refusing to pay homage to him for Wales, which was just a way of questioning Edward's authority that simply couldn't be tolerated and had to be dealt with. So, okay. I mean, those are some examples.
Sure. And so challenges to his authority were something that he really came down quite hard on. Do we get an impression from that as what his personality might be like?
Yeah, I mean, he's somebody who doesn't brook much opposition. He's not somebody who's terribly easy to advise. So he does have people in the first 20 years of the reign, in particular, who know him very well and have the ability to talk to him about things that he's doing in a critical way. Thereafter, when they've died, it's very, very difficult to advise him because he's got very fixed ideas about how things should be done. And he's at times pretty stubborn and easy to anger, really.
Do you think that his personality led to some of the failings that people see of him as having as king?
Yeah, I think it made a definite contribution. I mean, clearly he faces difficult situations on a number of occasions. So the 1290s, for example, the French king just confiscates Gascony in the southwest of France, and that's a really difficult situation to face. The problem thereafter is that Edward, in the various realms where he has sovereignty, insists on certain things that, particularly in England, for example, absolutely impoverishes people. He insists that they need to pay him tax to fight this defensive war, and they're saying to him, we've got no more money, you've bled us white. And he pushes and pushes and pushes, when actually, of course, he's in a tight spot, but politically, it wasn't very sensible. And certainly, some of the bad faith he showed during that crisis was very problematic. So in 1299, I think it is, or late 1290s, he leaves London secretly just to avoid, I think it's ratifying a statute. And in 1297, when the council at home has agreed a compromise, he's in Flanders, and he takes 2 weeks to sign it because he's so angry. And all of these things are things that politically are rather insensitive.
Yes, there's some quite striking accounts of other examples of his kind of violent temper, aren't there?
I mean, certainly there's things in the records that Michael Prestwich discovered, for example, about Edward. I think it was his own crown, but I'm not entirely sure, but he threw a crown around the room and it had to be repaired. So there's actually a bill in some of the Exchequer records for the repair of this crown that the king had smashed up. And there's another incident where I think it's one of his daughter's weddings. He beats somebody up so badly he has to pay them compensation.
Okay. And in terms of his personality, again, some critics have argued that he was overambitious. Do you think that this was the case?
I think it depends how you look at it. I mean, I think you could say he had big ideas, he tried them out and he failed. So 1279, he launched this massive inquiry into property and land, which was just like Doomsday Book, really. But you've got to remember that this period after Doomsday Book, hundreds of years, things have got a lot more complicated. The population's much, much bigger. This was a massive task, and it was almost bound to fail. On the other hand, you could say, well, if he hadn't had some of his big ideas, we wouldn't have had some of the major successes of the reign. And a good example of that is the Trailbastion Commissions into disorder in the early 1300s. So it's difficult. If you criticise somebody for overambition and they fail every time, it's a fair point. I think if you criticise somebody for overambition where actually a lot of it's worked, then that's more problematic.
Okay. You kind of mentioned in your piece that historians haven't really looked in any great detail about how Edward's actions affected his people. Why do you think this is?
I think historically, I mean, that in many ways, that reflects the way history as a discipline has developed. Historically, what historians of all periods were very interested in were institutions of government, things like parliament, for example, and high politics, politics at the centre, what's happening between nobles, for example, and the king. And it's only recently that historians generally have started to look at the everyday lives of people. So I think the Middle Ages, the historiography of the Middle Ages is in many ways not very atypical. It's just that recently it's benefited from trends that have occurred in history generally, or historiography generally.
I see. Okay. What were the main challenges that you faced in researching Edward?
I think the records are, while very extensive, more extensive than I think most people realise, I was trying to do something that had never been done before with them for the period that I'm looking at. And that really is to quantify disorder, to quantify conflict and crime. And that's very difficult. You have to be very imaginative about how you use the records while not stretching them beyond credibility. So that was a big challenge, thinking about the methodology of using what is a very rich variety of sources, but nonetheless one that has to be used carefully and imaginatively. It doesn't just tell you the answers.
Sure. So what kind of sources did you rely on?
Mostly legal records. Again, most people won't be aware quite how extensive the surviving legal records are for the Middle Ages. So we've got almost continuous runs of records from several courts at the centre and in them that went out to the localities. So we know about lots of disputes that people had with each other, the nature of those disputes, where they took place. Some of them are actually very entertaining. People quite more regularly than you might imagine tell us that they were beaten so badly that they were on the verge of death.
Wow.
So they're very interesting records and very extensive, but mostly legal.
You mentioned that he was successful in tackling crime. How did he achieve this?
Well, you have to be a bit careful when you're thinking about crime, because some of it's about perception of the person who's dealing with it, and sometimes it looks worse as a result of that. But nonetheless, if you look at the records, you can see evidence of the ways in which Edward was not just at times expressing general concern, but more importantly, looking at very, very specific issues in particular counties. And then you see the following year, for example, another commission sent to that county to deal with disorder, and then it stops. And another county is dealt with. Now, he's not just going around the counties there systematically. He's dealing with problems as they arise. And you see this so frequently that often the only conclusion you can derive is that he feels that a solution has been reached in the county once he stops sending commissions, because otherwise, why would he stop sending them?
Okay.
So you can see evidence of the crime being dealt with.
Sure. Something that struck me is how different the situation was in different counties around the country. So it seems like there were kind of many different problems to deal with all at once. Is it fair to say that there were a lot of different problems happening all around the country at the same time?
Yes, I mean, every county is different. So, for example, if you look at Kent in the Middle Ages, one of the things Kent suffers from is very, very big divergences between the richest in the county and the poorest in the county. So there's a lot of poverty, and you see, therefore, quite a lot of crime in which people are clearly attacking people who are much wealthier than them, or who are moving through the county with goods, for example, because, of course, Dover's a major port. If you go to Warwickshire, on the other hand, you're dealing with an entirely different set of problems. There you've got a rapidly growing population, a shortage of land, and fights over who gets that land. So it is very different. And as a king, obviously one size doesn't fit all. You've got to respond to the differing nature of problems that you face.
So, I mean, obviously it's hard to generalise in some cases, but how far do you think his actions change the lives of his subjects?
I think they did make a big difference. I think he dealt better than many kings had before him with threats to people's land, either from other people within the country or threats to land being appropriated, for example, by the Welsh prince and his allies. So in that sense, a big difference. alongside that, in a more kind of major structural way, this is the first king really to develop parliament and a system of taxation which brings in not just the nobility but the gentry and asks them for consent to that taxation, for a discussion about when they should grant it, which wars are acceptable. And that, of course, makes a very big difference to people's lives, because in a way it widens the political community and widens the scope of debate, which is a big move forward. At the same time, he passes the most amazing amount of legislation. And that's a big, big change, and that makes a big difference to people, right from how rape is dealt with to how other forms of crime are dealt with to how your disputes are dealt with. All of that is something that he makes changes to and improvements to.
Moving on to the final years of his reign, is it fair to say that these were disappointing?
I think it's unfair. I think it's one of the things that the historiography has increasingly done. So, you know, that the reign ended in disorder. Edward left his son with a couple of £100,000 worth of debt. The Scots were in rebellion. You could paint a very negative picture. You could also flip that picture around and say, well, actually, Edward had reached a very good accommodation with Scottish nobility, and the Bruce Rebellion of 1306 is in many ways more of a reflection of the fact that Bruce felt he was outside that accommodation for reasons that are complicated and not really in many ways Edward's fault. So in that sense, did Edward just push the Scots into rebellion? No. Was that a rebellion that, from an English perspective, could have been tackled? Yes, it possibly could, but the king died. So it's difficult to criticise Edward for dying. Trailbaston and disorder, Trailbaston being the commissions that Edward issued to deal with the disorder that had resulted from the big wars of the 1290s, has been assumed to be a failure. But actually, when I looked at it, there was lots of evidence that it had been a major success for him. So, yes, he left the king... who succeeded him in debt, and that is a reflection in many ways of Edward's inflexibility, his unwillingness to ask for taxation in the early 1300s, because he didn't want to negotiate with his subjects as he had to do in the late 1290s. He didn't want to make concessions. That's a criticism of his inflexibility, and in that sense that is a failure.
Okay, I mean, looking back at his reign as a whole, to what extent was he a typical medieval king?
Problem is, I don't think there's a typical king. So if you actually take the period after Edward, his son was deposed for being a terrible tyrant and was useless from the outset. Edward III, who came along after him, was absolutely brilliant. Then you have Richard II, who was utterly paranoid and also became a tyrant and also got deposed by Henry Bolingbroke. Then you've got Henry IV, who seized the throne from Richard II and was okay, but, you know, not a brilliant king. Then Henry V is brilliant, and then Henry VI, who may have been schizophrenic. So there is no typical medieval king. There is, if you like, an underpinning sense in political ideas at the time that they're widely circulating about how a king should behave. But unfortunately, where you have a situation in which kingship is... inherited, then you are taking a gamble on what your son is like, basically. And a lot of the time it doesn't work out terribly well. So there is no typical, in a way.
Okay. So in many ways you think he's not deserving of his current negative reputation?
Well, I mean, I'd go back to what I said earlier. I wouldn't say it's an entirely negative reputation. It's mixed at the moment. But I certainly think some of the negative elements, particularly in relation to how effectively he dealt with disorder and the final years of the reign, need to be revised, because they are overly negative, when in fact we might draw a number of positives from things he did and his achievements.
And finally, what do you think the true legacy of his reign is and should be?
Well, major thing, steps forward in the development of Parliament and taxation and legislation. And I think those are things that we should remember are a big legacy of Edward I, a major legacy. Developments in the ways in which the state tackled disorder. And there's undoubtedly huge strides forward on that front. And personal to Edward particularly, the commitment, I suppose, for the first time in the 13th century at least, to, if you like, public interests of the whole realm. In other words, an attempt to govern well. And in that sense, he's in some ways an exemplar of good kingship, and that should be his legacy.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
That was Caroline Burt talking to Matt Elton. Her book, Edward I and the Governance of England, 1272-1307, will be published by Cambridge University Press later this month. Caroline has also written a fascinating piece on Edward I for our latest issue, which is on sale now. And also in the magazine we've got articles on witch trials, Thomas Becket, Mussolini, American presidents and jiu-jitsu suffragettes. You can still get hold of that in the shops, as well as on Kindle and iPad. Maps have existed in different forms for many centuries, reflecting some of mankind's best and worst attributes, from discovery and curiosity to conflict and destruction. So says Simon Garfield, author of a new book on the subject. Our section editor Charlotte Hodgman spoke to Simon to find out what maps can tell us about culture and society, and what he believes is one of the most useful maps in the world, the London Tube Map.
So, Simon, your last book was about fonts and typefaces. What made you turn your attention to maps?
All my books, really, I think, have been kind of, you know, fairly diverse in their subject matter. But they've all been about things that I've been passionate about at one time or another in my life. And maps has been something that I think that's been there really all my life. And it wasn't my idea. I mean, I'd like to take full credit, but actually my American publisher just came up with the one word, which was just maps. And I thought for about 3 seconds and I thought, yes, I'm going to write a book about maps. I mean, I've been interested since I was a kid going to school, getting the Northern Line in London from Golders Green to Hampstead, where I went to school, and just looking at the tube map every day and thinking, God, you know, places like Hendon sound exotic. And the end of the Piccadilly line, thinking, oh, that's a place I'll never get to. So that was sort of, I think, the first sort of inkling that actually maps were interesting and could take you to places that seemed, as I said, you know, just exotic to me as a 10-year-old. And then after that, I think it wasn't through school, because I wasn't especially good at geography. I was interested in history, I think, far more. And And orthography is a lot more than maps. But I think it was a sort of, it really was the kind of the stories and the politics and the background to maps, rather than the something that I really appreciated a lot later, which was the kind of, I suppose, the beauty of maps that excited me originally. So, long-winded answer, but basically, I've always been interested in maps.
Okay, and how did you go about researching the book? Did you have to visit any specific places?
Yeah, I was very keen, really, to bring the maps alive. So I ended up, I think, for some reason, with 39 different maps that I look at in the book. And some of them are quite sort of rare and unknown, but some of them are sort of well known. So, for instance, the Mappa Mundi, or looking at maps of Mars. So, I was very keen, though, to just not sit in a library. I did go, obviously, spend a lot of time at the British Library and the London Library and the New York Public Library and the Royal Geographic Society and all of that, Geographical Society, I should say, just calling things up. And obviously, you look at a lot of things online. But I was also aware that because of my journalistic background, I could go out and talk to people and hopefully bring these sort of 2D images alive in a new way. So, for instance, the Mappa Mundi, you know, 1295 or so, and you think, well, you know, what's more to be said about it? But actually, I thought that the most interesting place to begin with that was the proposed sale of it, almost disastrous sale of it, in the late 1980s. So I thought, well, you know, who's around, who was involved in that? And actually, the Reverend Peter Haynes, who was then Dean of Hereford Cathedral, where the map is and was almost sold from, is alive still. He's, I think, now 89. So I went up to see him, really, to get his version of events, and he was terrific. And then, well, who better to talk to Maps of Mars than Patrick Moore? So I went to see Patrick Moore, and he wasn't very, very, very well, but my gosh, he had great tales about Mars, and most of them about how we, you know, up until the Mariner spacecraft went up there, we didn't really have any idea what it was really like. So he talked very amusingly about what we got wrong about Mars, and, you know, our imaginations that there were canals up there and all of that. And then I went to New York to talk to the greatest and I write in the book most feared and also, I think, kind of respected map dealer in the world, a man called W. Graham Arada III. And I interviewed him between, he came in after a very sweaty squash game and a big sale at an auction house where he was selling and buying all sorts of things. So I guess, you know, I went all over. Really, you know, so a lot of the tales are told from research that I got from books and then quite a lot as well as talking derives from fresh interviews.
And what would you say that maps can tell us about the culture and the society in which they were made?
Gosh, well, everything really, I think, is a simple answer. You learn a huge amount about science and religion and trade and power at the time. And obviously, you know, it depends on which period and which maps you're looking at. But if you take, the Mappa Mundi again, that's really a religious artifact as much as anything else. It's a sort of Christian worldview. So you look at that map, you learn a lot about how the church saw the world and how the people who drew up the map felt that, you know, pilgrims who went to see it in Hereford should think about the world, how they should live their lives. So Jerusalem is obviously at the center of that, and that's sort of, you know, the pinnacle, that's the ultimate goal, and fantastic visions of heaven and hell if you misbehave as well. And then you look at I think scientific mapping really began with the ancient Greeks, and you look at you learn a huge amount of what they knew of the world and what they thought was important about the world, and in other words, where they traded and where travelers came into the Great Library of Alexandria with fantastic reports, and these reports obviously went to the great librarians at Alexandria, including Eratosthenes, and then after that Ptolemy, and their great geographical writings tell us a huge amount. No maps survive directly from that period, but obviously the maps we have are reconstructed very much from their sort of atlas indexes, I suppose, from the time. And then obviously trade and power. So when one gets to the Renaissance, one looks at the varying degrees of influence of European countries and the strength of their navies and navigators, and one looks obviously at Portugal and Italy, Germany up to a point, and then the UK, or England, of course, and then I think, you know, you can look at power, a sense of nationhood, which obviously you get from military maps, but you also get it from sort of less aggressive maps. So one looks at the Cassini maps of France in the 18th century, which directly inspired our Ordnance Survey. And that's really about sort of protecting what we have and being able to map out land in terms of ownership and power.
And were there any particularly striking or unusual maps that stood out for you during your research?
All of them have, you know, their own kind of appeals, and that is either a particular story that they tell, or a mystery they reveal. But I think, as a group, the great pleasure I got was sort of, I suppose, exploding myths, and certain maps that had things on them that were wrong are always as interesting as the things that are right. And one doesn't want to appear too cynical in this. But for instance, I mean, one of the maps that I love looking at was 17th, or really 18th century, and 19th century maps of Africa and what we knew from there. So we thought we knew a huge amount more. You look at maps of Africa from great cartographers like Blau, who, you know, these maps were made in Amsterdam in the 17th century, and these are really beautiful things. And it looks like we know everything that there is to know about Africa. They're full, and classically, they're full with all sorts of places that don't exist. And you know, when they didn't know what was there, they classically put in elephants and other animals, and then. You actually look at the you know, the far more scientific maps of the 18th century, and you realise that we didn't really know anything at all. But one great thing in Africa, which I talk about, which first appeared in maps at really at the end of the 18th century, were this mythical mountain range called the Mountains of Kong. But fantastically gifted and well respected. British cartographer called James Rennell, who was very influential in mapping India. He just put these huge mountain range stretching from the west coast right through the middle of the country, called the Mountains of Kong, which didn't exist, but they appeared on maps for about 100 years. I write in the book that they were sort of the equivalent of a Wikipedia entry that sort of appears and then, you know, appears incorrectly in a thousand school essays, because no one has actually sort of checked that something is true. And it takes a while for this to be corrected. In the case of the Mountains of Kong, it took 100 years. And then, oh gosh, I don't know, I was trying to think. Another example. Oh, well, the classic one, I suppose, which again wasn't on maps, but it's a great myth, is this idea of the phrase "here be dragons," that we assume was on all these old medieval Dark Age maps, you know, places where sailors feared to sail and they saw terrible sea creatures, and they wrote in whatever language it would be, Latin, one assumes originally, you know, here be dragons, hic sunt dragones, and delighted to find that this actually didn't appear on any map at all. So if listeners can find a map with here be dragons on it, I mean, obviously not a modern map or a parody, but an old medieval map with here be dragons on it, then they would be making cartographical history.
And how do you think technological innovations such as Apple Maps and the internet have shaped our view of the world?
I mean, I you know, as someone who loves old maps, not really through, you know, not for nostalgic reasons, but just because you realize, you know, obviously having written a book, you realize their value. And I have a sort of love-hate relationship with digital maps. But I do wonder about, you know, for instance, my kids are growing up without really any need to know how to open, you know, a map. To find their way on, let's say, Ordnance Survey, or even an old-fashioned A to Z, and you think, actually, well, the reason they don't need that is because they, you know, they've just grown up with three maps on their computers and on their phones. So I think we are losing a huge amount, but we're also gaining a huge amount. So we lose, you know, any idea of actually where we are when we look at a sat nav or a handheld device. We can see, you know, if we're lucky, 100 yards ahead, with no idea about what we're passing on either side, and no idea of, you know, we can go from one end of the country to another without knowing how we really got there. And yet, obviously, it's also a great tool. It's not a great tool if you're up the middle of Snowdonia and you know, your batteries run flat, or there's no GPS. But in so many other ways, I mean, it's such a kind of key part of our lives now. And I put in the book that, you know, if we lost GPS, it would be like, you know, if all the satellites fell from the sky at once, it would be like losing electricity, gas, and you know, sort of any other energy supply all at once. Really, I think it would be that colossal. But then one has to ask, well, you know, we don't really know how to plow a field now, most of us, obviously. You know, in agricultural times, if we didn't know how to do that, it would be disastrous. But now we can't read a map. You know, so new generations perhaps have difficulty reading a map. Is that a great loss? Not so much for them, really. You know, in conclusion, I think I have both good and bad feelings towards digital maps.
Okay, and who, in your opinion, has created the most useful map in history?
Well, spot for choice, and obviously it depends on which period we're talking about. I mean, personally, I would probably go back to my tube maps, really. So Harry Beck, for me, every day in London, or almost every day in London, you know, if I'm working, I would probably use the tube in some way. And even though I've been looking at it for something like 40 years, I still have to consult it. It's not something you learn off by heart. And its influence has obviously been so vast. A lot's been written about the tube map, but its influence all over the world and its significance as a, you know, as a geographically incorrect map, famously, you know, the tube stops aren't obviously, you know, the same distance apart, and the middle of London is obviously far more compressed than it looks on the map. But as a diagram, it's probably one of the most important maps ever made, and I think as well probably the most reproduced map ever made. But then, I don't know, you know, from an aesthetic point of view, I would say the Blau atlases from the 17th century, just absolutely gorgeous things. Now, you know, unaffordable, really, unless you're hugely wealthy. But there are Taschen have really recently brought out a wonderful reproduction, I think, from the Atlas from 1665. That's a hugely useful thing, even now, to understand what people in the 17th century knew of the world and how much, really, they knew of the world. But then you look at the Ptolemy's Geographica, also, you know, 2,000 years old or so, fantastically useful. And then I think if you're honest now, the most useful map ever made, Google Maps. I think quite hard to argue against it. Everybody has access to it free. Everyone uses it all over the world. And it's pretty damn good as well.
And do you think our ancestors had the same need that we seem to have to learn about the world through maps?
Yeah, I think as much. I mean, the thing I was talking about before, you know, the use of and the emergence of scientific principles in ancient Greece were significant, but as significant because they disappeared for something like 1400 years, and only reappeared at the beginning of the Renaissance. I think the disappearance tells us a lot about how maps weren't regarded as significant in getting about the world. Now we regard them as tools pretty much, and unless we're just enjoying them in a museum or exhibition, we regard them as, you know, how to get from, you know, A to B, how to plan our holidays, you know, how to find out where a city in China is. But then they were far more they were far more symbols of power. So there was I think there was very much a thinking that if you controlled the map, you controlled the world, or you certainly controlled an element of trade. It's only been really, I think, in the last 100 years or so, or maybe you could argue less, that we all have fairly free access to maps. I mean, obviously it would cost a little bit to buy an Ordnance Survey map on, or an A to Z or an atlas or whatever, but they were, you know, fairly freely affordable. So it's, you know, obviously the significance of maps sort of changes fundamentally over the centuries, but we obviously travel far more than we ever did as well, so the significance of maps in, let's say, guidebooks when we're going abroad has obviously been far more important. I mean, I know we had the Grand Tour and everything, but, you know, it was only when guidebooks really came into their own in sort of Victorian times that we used maps sort of every day in the same way that we do now.
And what do you think our medieval forebears would have made of what you refer to in the book as me mapping, or maps that place the user at the centre of everything?
Well, I think they, they would have been, I think, both horrified and amused and not really be able to sort of, you know, understand the concept at all. I mean, obviously the idea of, you know, walking around with maps in our hands that change as we walk is an extraordinary thing. And the idea of me mapping that I write about in the book is, you know, that it's a very sort of egocentric thing, whereas before, you know, as I said, Jerusalem would be at the centre of the map, or perhaps it would be the British Empire or Paris at the heart of the French Empire. You know, now it's us. Now it's always us. So there's this idea that we are the most important thing on the map, rather than being a very insignificant, tiny little dot. Even if you lived in a major city, it would be a very, very small part of the world map. Now you don't really see the world map. Now it's all about us getting to, you know, the train station or the meeting place where we're going to meet a friend or whatever it is. But I think they would be astonished that we don't look up, really. You know, we don't see the world around us perhaps in the same way, and I think that's obviously a bad thing, and a thing that we really have lost. That maps are very practical in the way that they never were, but there's also a kind of feeling that, you know, perhaps we don't understand. I mean, I haven't talked to anyone who teaches geography in schools, but I do know that we don't have a globe in every classroom the way we did. We don't have world maps, you know, on the walls the way we did. So I think they would be slightly perturbed, really, that we although we have as many maps as we need and maps, you know, freely available at all times, that they would be slightly worried that we don't perhaps understand the beauty and the grandeur of the world.
That was Simon Garfield. And if you like what you heard, you can plot a course to your nearest bookshop and get hold of his latest book, On the Map, which is published by Profile. Well, that's about all for this episode. Do join us next week when we'll be discussing Mussolini's followers and medical history. And in the meantime, do have a look at our website, historyextra.com, where you'll find all manner of great content. And you can, of course, keep in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook too. The History Extra podcast is recorded in Bristol and produced by Dave Gibson.